I want to welcome everyone to the second talk in Contemplating Death and Dying. And what we're doing as a group, and hopefully in the interim times between meeting, is we're bringing a subject up for reflection, a very important subject that I hope everyone continues to work with the subject long after this evening departs. And it's the willingness to incline one's mind towards this subject, that vast storehouses of information and understanding and insights begin to dawn on us. Just to show you a small example, last night at the beginning series, in the question and answer section of that, one man spoke of working with his emotions just by feeling them in the body, the sensations of them, and not playing forth with the content. And he said as he was doing that, he would get lost a little bit in the thought, but then come back to his body and get lost a little more in the thought and come back to his body. And as he was moving back and forth between the thought and the body, he was thinking, my God, if I don't give myself over to thinking about this thing, I'm not going to learn anything significant about it. And in the response to that, I said, it's just the opposite. We think what we need to learn is the continuation of the theme of ourself. When an emotion arises, we want to understand the justification for why that emotion has occurred at all, and the antecedents of it, and where my mother came in around it, and why this particular aspect of my personality and character is formed early on. And I said, how has that allowed you to hold the emotion? How has that allowed you not to react? Knowing the information, which most of us can trace that back in history pretty easily, how does that allow us to settle with the emotion, knowing that it doesn't? It gives you a sense of self-continuity in relationship to the emotion, but it really doesn't allow a settledness, a stopping with the emotion. It allows a continuance of theme, but not a stopping, not an arresting. I said, what we're really afraid of is that arresting, that stopping, the death that we partake when we don't add anything to anything else, when we don't add a story to a particular fixture of ourselves. Because our whole life has been a storytelling around the different dispositions and characteristics and qualities that we have. So we're actually strangling with ourselves with the story. But how has that led to a sane and aware life? We have to die to that in order to resurrect the true orientation, the true and natural relationship to all things. So the death that we're speaking about, of course, is around the physical demise of the body, but that's not where the subject stops, obviously. It moves into vast depths beyond that, into the psychic and spiritual deaths, which is where this is actually pointing. But we'll never get there if we are flinching continually around the physical demise. That's the one that gets our attention, and that's the one that we worry most about. The spiritual one seems like, oh, I can do that anytime. But, of course, we can't, because the same fear that governs our physical demise governs our psychic demise as well. And although it seems and appears to be easier, and one that we can do in the course of our spiritual training, we never actually get to that point of actually stopping, do we? Because it is a frightening, almost terrorizing event to actually release the need to continue moment after moment. And we'll talk more about that later in this talk. But so we're just inclining our minds. We're just welcoming the subject for once. We're just inviting and entertaining the subject. We're dancing with it. And think of it more in terms of that, a dance with the subject, so that I can feel how this partner waltzes with me here and what is the significance of a relationship with this subject? And does it begin to create opportunities for new areas of learning and insight into myself? And is there a kind of worrisome feature about this relationship as well? Is there a creeping fear or contraction that often allows or points to a possibility, a potential that if the fear wasn't there, wouldn't be the same, wouldn't have the same quality to it? The fear is the fear of what I might learn if I actually open to the subject. And so when we do open to the subject, what we learn is directly proportional to the degree of fear we have of it. And so, of course, death holds an enormous. In fact, most of my Dharma understanding, or as much of my Dharma understanding, did not come from meditation as it did from actually being at the bedside of the dying. Equal amounts. When I left the forest of Thailand and then joined the bedside of people who were terminally ill, I felt I lost nothing in terms of my spiritual growth and depth. In fact, one complemented and fed the other. So you'll go as far with you as you would like. And that is why every time I join this subject, and I invite you to do the same, join it with innocence, not with your sophistication. I've seen hundreds and hundreds, perhaps thousands of people die, and I know no more about it than I did when I was first at the bedside of the first person. It defies knowledge base. It defies an intellectual understanding of what is happening. Yes, you can talk about the sequential physical breakdown of the body. You can talk about what the mind and family go through in the course of that. But what is actual death? What is it? Is a vast mystery. And so we be very cautious in trying to fill that mystery with an afterlife or continuation of yourself. Those are just ways that we comfort ourselves from the mystery so that we don't have to be completely open to what is completely and forever unknown to us. And so, okay, let's just begin to be innocent with this thing. The real innocence, it asks for innocence. It asks for innocence. Plato, I like to show you the different ways that some of the wise men of our history have related to death and dying. And so I just like to start with this Plato's definition he said, the true devotees of self-knowledge practice nothing else but how to die. So you begin to hear it across the ages, you know. Malarepa 2 weeks ago, Plato, you know, different areas of the world, obviously far apart and yet coming to a common theme. And so tonight, I want to explore the homework that I'm giving each of you and what the Buddha was talking about. And I'm just going to read it because then we're going to take it apart and look at our own irresolution of each of these points that the Buddha is making. He says, somebody asks him, do all mortals fear death? And he says, no, not everyone. Only those who thirst after sense pleasures, or thirst after the body, or perform a lifetime of unwholesome deeds, or are confused about the way things are, fear death. So the rest of you can leave. See, what I like about that is that he is... he's really dealing with the unfinished business of our life. He's addressing the residue, the caves where we hide. He's going back and he's sort of cleaning out the pantry, you know, the corners there. And he's saying, okay, look, you know, you think you've been working And you'll know that you've been working because at some point you will meet death fearlessly. So those of you who want to finish this, here's a good way to decide or to discern for yourself whether you're ready to meet death fearlessly. Do you thirst after sense pleasures? Do you thirst after the body? Have you performed a lifetime of unwholesome deeds? And do you understand the way things are? Because if you do, you have nothing, there will be no fear. So we go, okay, so I see what's left here. I see what I have left to do. And the postponement, the procrastination, is fine until we start bringing forth subjects which begin to show us where we're delaying our life. It's fine as long as everything's beautiful and pretty. Nothing's going on that really, yes, minor irritations or relationship problems, or I have a problem with my boss or the neighbor's hedge or something. And so it's like this, my practice must be going really well. I must be really doing well because I'm sort of sailing along here. And then all of a sudden we get a lump on our breast. And we're thrown completely off center. This was unexpected. I didn't buy into this. And what happens then, you see? Where is the practice then? It's fine when things are going smoothly, but where is it in confusion? Where is it in chaos? Where is it in the mixed of life? Where is when life stops playing softball, slow pitch, and then it starts throwing in fast hardballs? What about that? And we see that we could be sort of placating ourselves, just kind of humming along here, never really challenging, never asking the questions which would challenge us. Avoiding those questions, really, staying away from them. And it's sobering when the Buddha puts it down, which I love the way he does. He just doesn't mix words. He says, okay, here's it, here it is, right here. Okay, so go to work. I mean, has our life sustained a kind of grasping hold that we have on it, and that we just haven't hit the rapids sufficiently to know that we're even grasping and holding it in the way we're doing? Is our life based around fear that just hasn't been exposed? We feel it, but we stay safe distance away from any exposure to that. Woody Allen's rule of thumb is, I don't mind dying, he says, as long as I don't have to be there when it happens. But we, the Vipassana student, the insight student, we want to be there when it happens. We want to see it, don't we? And it's an idealization of it. We don't want to have to have it hurt. We want it to be kind of pleasurable. But we want to see it, right? It's a naiveness. Like I remember when I was early on in my training at IMS, I would decide I was going to go sit all night at a cemetery. So I took my little zafu out and full moon so I could make it be as haunting as I could have it, and sat out there, and it went fine. It wasn't even a problem. I thought this was really, it was like ideal. I was going to throw myself into the jaws of the tiger, right? Well, then, I was a monk in Asia, and I was walking along a beach to alms round, and I had to walk a couple of miles to get to the village where I could receive food. So I was just walking along the beach, and I saw this little hump in the sand, and I looked down, and it was a dead body on the beach. And I just, suddenly the cemetery idealization came to the realization, the fact, the reality of what death was. We're not playing here. So happens that during that time, the Vietnamese boat people were being attacked by pirates, and bodies were sort of strewn around on the beaches from the death that occurred on the bay there of Thailand. But I just remember just this cold chill of the fact, you see a body washing up on the beach. It just didn't seem like play to me anymore. Somehow it was, it was all about the cemetery again, you know. I don't know how many of you have been watching that World War II by Ken Burns. But those of us who remained at home, none of us here, but those people who remained at home during the fighting, there was an idealization. I couldn't get over the innocence of how people related to the war. They were doing their job, you know, they were rationing their gasoline and, you know, giving money to the war bond effort and would speak about it as helping our boys, you know. And then when it would flash to the battle scenes where live Japanese were being cut open to get their gold teeth. I remember this story in particular on Okinawa by a U.S. soldier who had lost everything. He lost all proportionality, and a live Japanese, the American soldier wanted the gold teeth that the Japanese had, so he just slid his cheek from side to side and went in after the teeth while the Japanese prisoner was alive. See, that, where is that? You see, the war bond effort, and, you know, it's lifetimes away from each other here. And in our practice, we can have the innocence, we can have that innocence, the kind of bubbling innocence, oh, you know, I'm going to make a good effort, death, yes, let's go, you know, I'll start looking at corpses. But by God, when you get a lump on your breast, you're on the sands of Iwo Jima. And we can see the worlds apart. The fiction, the way the mind is played upon it, is almost something pleasurable, as opposed to the cold, hard, stark reality of what dying really means. And as one hospice worker said to me, he said, I have to wake up every morning to my own death to be effective with the patients at all. Every morning. And I would see it in myself. As a clinician, I would go out to the home and suddenly I would just, you know, I've done this before. I've been through this many times, like I had died many times, right? I've just been through what I was tired of the story of. So, you know, you get glossed over, and it's very hard not to, no matter what you do. And you go, wait a second here, this person's never died, and I'm pretending in my mind as if I'm just answering habitually to them. And you go, okay, now let me tune in here, because this person is screaming inside for someone to connect, and I'm offering them platitudes. It's the simple answer of it all. We can make every theme and Dharma just have a casualness. Like the way you won't hear me speak about impermanence the way some teachers do, because I think it's overused. I think it's all the richness of it has been just whitewashed out in 100 washes, 1,000 washes. We understood truly the impermanence of things, we would question any sense of continuity whatsoever, because there isn't any. All life is an experience. You move your head from here and here, you have two completely different experiences, two completely different worlds. One has died and the other was just born. That's impermanence. And every moment is completely washed away. There will never be another moment like that. Yet we tie it together like strings through a popcorn to decorate the tree. But when we start talking about death, we're called back to question that continuity. Unless we're given to the belief systems within religiosity. It's like, okay, there's a heaven, you know, I will continue, so we'll just march it right forth. But death is meaning something else here. It's showing us something else. Where are we abiding? If we're abiding in time, if we're just moving through time, we're just fooling ourselves. We're the innocents on the other side of the ocean of the war, saving our bonds, buying bonds, rationing our gas. Right? Global warming. We'll ration our gas. No, global warming means deaths to thousands, millions. That's what it means. So you see, we have to take it to the level that it drops us to a new level here. It's not thirsting after sense pleasures. It's not just, it's all going to be okay, dear. Have a, you know, now I lay me down to sleep. No, it's, something's going to be terribly different when we wake up. And we infuse so much of life with our need to control it and order it and make it predictable and comfortable within that prediction, so that if there's an outlier, we know exactly how to move around that outlier so that it'll never happen again. But what do we do about global warming? Let's see us move around that outlier. Because that threatens our thirst for sense pleasure. That threatens the very reason that some of us take birth to begin with. Now what are we going to do? Because that's going to be the death of something, some tenacious way that we hold on to life. And may I say that there are a few of us in this room who have not use life with that orientation of comfort. That many of us in the room still believe that happiness is to be pursued through pleasure. Sense pleasure. And yet that's one of the reasons death is so feared. Not only would I have to give up the comfortable, because death doesn't sound so comfortable, does it? Let me read to you. It doesn't sound comfortable, no. This is from a very good book called Lessons from the Dying. I recommend it if you haven't read it. There is a part here about Lama Yeshe. Lama Yeshe was a highly regarded Tibetan meditation teacher who was hospitalized after suffering a severe heart attack. Sometime later, he wrote a letter to another Tibetan Lama about the period of illness. It read, "Never have I known the experiences and sufferings that attended my stay in intensive care. Due to the powerful medication, an ending injection, and oxygen tubes just to breathe, my mind was overcome with pain and confusion. I realized it is extremely difficult to maintain awareness without becoming confused during the stages of death. At its worst, 41 days after I became ill, the conditions of my body was that I became the lord of the cemetery. My mind was like that of an anti-god, and my speech like the barking of an old mad dog. As my ability to recite prayers and meditations degenerated for many days, I considered what to do. I did finally stabilize myself in strong meditation through great effort, and finally rose above the confusion. See? Yeah. Okay. So I can't sit this morning because I have a cold, right? Right? Right. Or I'm tired. Nobody sits when they're sleepy, do they? So you see, our death is going to be like, I'm going to be bright, attentive. You know, body's not going to hurt. I'm just going to be dying. That's all. And so it'll all work out. It'll all be worked out. The edges will be smooth. Are we willing? And this is I'm asking us here. Are we willing to sit with the uncomfortable? Are we willing to expand out beyond our boundaries, beyond the ways that we hold ourselves within what is predictable and safe? And then, yes, we can always get up because I'm sleepy. But getting up when you're sleepy is giving in to something else, isn't it? And perhaps the Buddha was pointing to that when he said, those who thirst after sense pleasures will always be afraid of dying. And we maintain ourselves. We just keep ourselves going all day long. In fact, the busier we become, the more alive we feel we are. And our aliveness is how much people need me, really. Often, I'm coming to that conclusion more than any other. Because anyone who carries the equipment belts that we carry, with our cell phones and displays and all of that, we don't need that because it saves us time. In fact, has email saved you time? We do it because we think we're more needed when we have access to that. And so our aliveness is based not on the realities of what it means to be alone with oneself, but on mind-generated busyness. Where the Buddha, he was a monk, simple monk, content with little, content with little. Just a statement of that, just the realization of just sitting down, you see. When we're sitting down, we're content with little, and we'll deal with whatever comes. That's what the practice is about. We'll deal with whatever comes. And we don't need much. In fact, we just need a pillow to sit on, regardless of the conditions. Can I find what's alive, irrespective of the conditions? Or is my aliveness determined by the conditions? Because that's the question between the worldly meditator and the correct orientation to meditation. How do I sit? And what am I sitting for? The beautification of mind? That's nice. You're going to follow you right into death, isn't it? And your body? Because I've read where you have better immune responses if you meditate. That's why I'm sitting. All of that is going to it's going to take you only so far, and then at some point you're going to be confronted to the limits of that understanding. And boy, it will come when that beautification of mind and the falling away of the body is present and right on top of us. And the Buddha goes on, he says, secondly, those who thirst after the body will fear death. Now let us be real honest here. How many of us are beyond the image of our appearance? Most of us have a deep attachment to the body. And it is, it's a great grounding instrument. It's a great stability and foundation for our return to the present. For the willingness to return to the present within the body. But if it's just based upon that, if our ability to be a present is only based on the body, what happens when the body falls away? Or gets sick, or disadvantaged, or crippled, or ages? I remember when I was younger, I didn't want to see dead bodies. And I delivered newspapers to a funeral home. And I had to deliver the paper walking through one of the open casket forums that they have there. And so I would pay my friends to go take the paper in. And I'd end up losing money at the end of the week on the paper route. My first foray into business. And as monks, we would go to charnel grounds and watch bodies be burned, or we would go to autopsies in the city. And some monks would, there's a meditation in which 32 parts of the body, there are 32 different locations that you put your attention and see what that object and part of the body actually feels like and experience it deeply, so that we begin to loosen the grasping hold that we have and the identification we have with the body. Because this is the horse that carries us through the journey. And it ages and it gets sick, and we care for it, and we abide within it. But to consider the fact that to get so attached to it that we suffer along with its condition, well, you can see how fear would naturally arise at the end of one's life when they can't take the body with them. In fact, I have known people who knew such things, which I don't, tell me that after someone dies, they often hang around the body if there was a lot of attachment to it, trying to bring it back to life, not being willing to admit that the death has occurred. You want to do that? When I was watching autopsies in the East, because I had been sitting for a long period of time, I'd have that feeling of feeling the consciousness hovering around the body because the death had just recently occurred, and you could feel the awareness, you know, trying to come back in. So the question is not, see, the body is an experience, really. But what holds that experience? It's not contained within the physical formation of that. What holds the experience of body? What holds the experience of mind? When we move from the experience level, investing in the experience, to what holds the experience, then we're moving into the sacred. But to do that, we have to die to the body. We have to die to the mind. And then the Buddha goes on and he says, the third reason that people fear death is they perform a lifetime of unwholesome deeds. I thought that was interesting. I thought it was interesting that it would bring that in. And I started thinking about it. I said, well, the most obvious reason is that you think of that you're going to be have to pay retribution for all the... You start worrying, like I'm sure O.J. Simpson, as he gets older. So you get, you know, so you start, your consciousness, you begin to be conscious of what you have done and the harm you've caused. And if you believe in such things in the terms of damnation and hells and all of that, so okay, that's fair enough. But I think he was pointing to something deeper than that. You see, when we're just concerned about oneself and one's welfare, and one's concern is to maximize my pleasure, and I don't care how I do that because it's all about my own circumstances and well-being, then I'll do anything to anyone. I will manipulate and distort, grasp, steal, lie, or worse, because it's for self-gratification. And so the emphasis has been on self. And so the thoughts are all around self. And now this self is beginning to die. And there's no way out. There's no bargaining chip we can play. There's no one you can force to take your place. And so when we look at it from that point of view, the unwholesome being the infusion and investment in I, me and mine, well, none of us escape that, do we? And you become very aware of the character we have formed over these decades. We become very aware of what we have carried, the baggage we have carried, the infusion and the continual infusion into the script of our own gratification and our own sense of selfishness and our own sense of isolation. And we have to really take stock to that and look, okay, wait a minute here, let's look at this. Because that smothers the heart. There's no heart when one is only concerned about oneself. And it's the relaxing of that tendency that allows the heart to emerge. And if the heart's going to emerge, then it has to do that through the conduit of considering other people and other situations besides what one's own values are. That's where metta comes in. Metta is we've spent so much time leaning to the left, it begins to lean us to the right, to begin to equal that distribution, that balance, so that we begin to consider the well-beings of others, to take us out of self-investing thought. But we can't stop there. Metta is just a rebalancing. We have to actually see what this sense of self is so that we don't behave as if it has a reality that it doesn't. And so the investigation keeps going deeper until it makes no sense, as the Buddha said, to say I, me, or mine is pure insanity. That's why we encourage connecting. I think, you see, when we start, are the willingness to connect through view, through the orientation of our spiritual lives to connect. Once we're connected, the heart can begin to display, can begin to access what we are connected with, connecting with our emotions, connecting through the emotions to what seems or appears to be external to oneself, all of that. It's the key to establishing that turnaround is the willingness to follow the truth of life back towards interconnectedness. And to know that the impulse to come back into oneself and self-protective or defensive posture is only an impulse. It's only a conditioned reference. It has no basis other than what we have learned to do for ourselves. I remember when somebody was dying on our service, and he had been a very selfish man, had been somewhat abusive to his family, had always considered his own needs and had dismissed other people's opinions. And he was dying, and he started having dreams in which he, on his deathbed, he was in need, and he was reaching out, but everybody was turning their backs to him. And in fact, that's what was actually happening. His family did not want to care for him because of the type of person he had been. And so this unfinished, out-of-balance character has to be tended to at some point. It will come back. It will come back. We're not going to get out of here without dealing with it. Better to do it now. Better to do it now. And then the final way the Buddha says we fear death is because we are confused about the way things are. We make death into a shadow of life. We make death into the shadow of life, you see. When really the two arise simultaneously. Because, as I was mentioning, every experience holds its end and the birth of a new. Think what it would be like if nothing died. If all your thoughts lasted. If your emotions never left you. Thank God for death. For the simultaneity of death. But we don't honor it, do we? The way things are, the willingness to actually look and to see what life is and has always been about, cannot be understood without including death. It has to include death. Equally. But when we invest only in having an experience and the continuity of experience, then we relegate death to a shadowy, hooded, sigh-carrying creature that sneaks up on us. And as the cartoon I showed last week where the man and death were arm in arm, and the man turns to death, again he had the sigh. He says, "What's taking you so long?" The warmth of connection, of companionship, says to me that he has lived with death his whole life. And that life and death have coexisted, which it has to. And we need side with neither. We don't take sides either way with this. It has no, there's no resolution to the dispute. The polar opposites meet in being, in manifestation, here, in this moment. So what doesn't die? Yes, we talked all evening long about what does, but what doesn't die? What doesn't die holds what does. When someone was very close to their last hours and they were receptive, sometimes I could sit down with them and just walk them through, saying, okay, now you're experiencing your body, but your body is not what it used to be, very close to its ending, but is there something in you that is undiminished, even as your body goes through its last roar? Is there something that's undiminished? Is there something in you that has not been touched through this entire illness? Let's go there together. Let's go there now. Let's go there now together. Can we sit for a minute or two? So as we sit, as I like to do sometimes, just you can feel the experiences arising. And some of us can feel the investment we have in having those experiences, like thoughts or emotions, and wanting there to be a story with all of that. So we don't allow its natural death. In reality, it doesn't last. We maintain it through our words. But what is life in this moment as it is in reality, in the reality of this moment? If we didn't sew it together, what would it really be here and now? When we ask ourselves that in seriousness, a new dimension arises. And the experiences continue, but they don't fool us. So if there are any questions or comments about anything, yes.
Decided that she wanted to fly back and live in New Jersey for the rest of her life, but that's where her family was. So we went up to go to the next before I took her to the airport. And she got out and we hugged, and it was pretty intense. So I got back in my car.
So you want me to comment on that? I'd be happy to. Yeah, so he was sharing a story where he was with his friend and they were parting, and likely because of age and distance in the parting that he might not ever see her again, and he felt the tremendous sense of sorrow, but at the same time, awe, a sort of an aliveness there, if I can say that, right? So that you were on fire in a certain way, alive, yes, good. And at the same time, the sorrow was not diminished, so they coexisted, didn't they? The loss and the aliveness. So it's interesting because usually we only make only one side of that available in grief. We make the loss the whole of the focus, our whole focus. And we get lost in the what our life will be without this person, and then the misery deepens and we have a prolonged or protracted grief around that. But if you stop for a moment, when there is an absence, there is a hole. There is something that isn't filled. And what we usually fill it with is our emotion of grief. That sustains, that covers over the hole. But in the loss of something, the absence of something, something falling away, there is the mystery of life also arising simultaneously. And that mystery has, it's an inspiring mystery. It's an alive mystery. It's not a dead mystery. It's not a fearful mystery. It's liveness itself, that when there isn't a dependency, which is what, when there is a releasing, a letting go, and there's not a dependency or a new thing to fill up that dependency, that hole allows for a vertical posture, for a posture of aliveness, you might say, against the neediness, the grasping that was there prior. I have a very good story around that particular theme. We were with, most of you have heard it, but just because it fits, I'll say it tonight. There was a young woman who was had two small children, who was dying in her home and asked to be taken to our inpatient unit, which we had in Texas at that point. And we usually don't take people to their inpatient unit. We usually want them to die in their home, but she was insistent. So we took her to the inpatient unit. And as she got into bed, surrounded by all the hospice workers and her family, she started to actively die. Most people who actively die are unable to speak, but she was able to speak, and so she was telling us what it was like to actually die. And we were gathered around her bed as she went through her dying process, and she said, you know, I can't feel my body anymore, and I can't hear anymore. And she went through each sense door until she, and then she said, my God, I'm no longer in my body. And then she tried to speak and died. So I was just enthralled, as all of us would be, because I felt like the mysteries of the universe were being revealed. But more importantly, the effect it had on the family. For 15 or 20 minutes, we could not move from the side of that bed. Everybody just was in this state of absolute, we were just totally enthralled, enamored by what we had just all heard together. Until well into 15 or 20 minutes, one of the family members broke down in grief. And then everybody coalesced around that grieving person, and then the story of grief blew away the mystery. But for that period of time, there was nothing in the room but the mystery itself. And that sustained us all in quietude. And that was the all of the absence. Other questions or comments? Yes. Like World War II.
Exactly. So like, yeah. I don't even know, do I fear my own death, because it seems such a distant concept.
Okay.
That, and I've tried to carry the awareness that I will die with me, but it feels almost like it's easier to connect to the moment to moment deaths that take place.
Okay. Okay. So the question is regarding, he feels like his physical death is more of an abstraction than a reality, and he doesn't know how to connect with it. So that's what last week's or 2 weeks ago homework was, that you just start including seeing it. You start seeing it. You aren't actively dying. So that's an abstraction for you. So we start looking for, including death in the scope of our events, the experiences we're having. We start looking at change. We start noticing roadkill. we start seeing the end of a thought or the lapse of the memory or something forgotten or something missed or something that ends. We start this end of fall and the beginning of winter. All of it. It's just around us all the time. And if you, as you begin to trace that back even more personally, experience. Just look at what we call life. It's a organization of physical data. Okay, so it's an experience. So this is what we each are having, and the only thing we can have and have ever had in our life is an experience of life. And one experience is so vastly different than another that it's a continuous ending that really makes no sense at all except how the mind organizes it. And how we lean on certain steps, certain experiences for the sense of our life and the purpose and meaning we give it. And other experiences, which includes death, to be antithetical to that. When it's just an experience, death is an experience too. What is it that holds the experience? That's what I want to know. What is it that has the experience? That has the capacity for experience to be known? Does that die? So don't get lost in trying to think of one's own physical death, because it is an abstraction for most of us, unless we're sick. But begin to include the ending of things rather than the investment in youth and vigor and energy, and because that's where the culture is. The culture just invests in one half of the equation and shadows the other side of it. It doesn't honor wisdom. It doesn't honor the elders of our culture. It honors a wrinkle-free face and white teeth and uplifted breasts. Other questions or comments by anyone? Yes.
When you sat with people at the end and you went with them to that undiminished sense, what was your experience? I mean, I know that it must have been as different as this many people you sat with, but was there some common sense of that undiminished essence?
The question is, when I sat with somebody and would work and talk with them through going to a place in them that was undiminished, what was there? I have no idea what their experience was, but often their faces unfurled, their brow was, often I could feel a relaxation and an ease. And, if I journeyed with them, then quite likely there was a companionship there of ease meeting itself. It's a wonderfully rich moment. And we don't get too caught up in what we're leaving. So many patients, families put their own pictures around the patients. But that holds them back. If we don't get too caught up, and we do allow the person to just move through, sometimes, not often, it's a readiness like anything else. There can be. It's rare. So, we're only talking about a handful out of thousands. Somebody can journey with you, can really understand it because they're experiencing the elimination of everything else. And if they're not tied to the loss of what they're losing, that which is undiminished will show itself. It's not as if you have to suddenly find it. It's there when we're not holding on to what is leaving. And so the opportunity is rich. That's why most traditions, spiritual traditions, make such a point of it. Okay, good. Thank you all for this evening very much.